Welcome back to the American Revolution Podcast, episode 61, The British Fleet is Moving South. So over the last few episodes, we've been talking about what's really going on with the American fleet, but we haven't spent a lot of time talking about the British fleet. And so I wanted to devote this episode this week to talking about what was going on the British side of things. At St. John, they are working tirelessly to build a fleet, moving men and supplies from the Upper Richelieu to the St. Lawrence shipyard. Like the Americans, the British were hit with delays. The weather was unpredictable, men were coming down with dysentery, and the sheer magnitude of this undertaking was taking its toll. The man in charge of this undertaking, Commodore Douglas, sat back and watched as July turned to August. But by mid-August, he got a bit of a reprieve, because the second wave of German troops had arrived from the European continent. But what was more interesting about this second wave was that it also carried the shipwrights that he would need to complete his task. And though the shipwrights were an added bonus, it wasn't enough for Commodore Douglas. He's still going to see August disappear, and we're going to get into early September, and the fleet is still yet to be complete. So, it's not really a surprise that early one morning in September, when cannons are heard in the distance, the entire British camp goes on the alert. Now, what they don't know is that it was the American fleet just welcoming the Lee and the New Jersey to their ranks. But the close proximity of the fleet meant that the Americans could be there any day. Douglas would rest easier knowing that he could finish in peace. And so the camp would stay on alert. But by the end of September, Douglas was pleased with how the fleet was coming along. The Royal Convert was beginning to come together, while the Thunderer was showing signs of her design problems. On September 27th, the schooners Maria and Carlton were completed and sent off to Isle Anou to await the rest of the fleet. Thomas Pringle would be in command of the fleet as far as battle was concerned. Commodore Douglas was in charge of building the fleet, whereas Captain Pringle was in charge of the fleet when it hit the waters and was fighting the Americans. And Pringle would choose the Maria as his flagship, which, when looking at the ship numbers as far as size, speed, capability, the Maria was by far one of the best schooners that the British had on the lake at the time. A ship that was, however, supposed to turn the tide of the whole battle, the Thunderer, well, that's a completely different scenario altogether. You know, we kind of talked about it before, the sheer magnitude of this vessel, but I'm going to break down the numbers one more time. Now, this ship sported six 24-pound cannon, with another six 12-pounders. Besides that, the sailors that were on board, they would also have two companies from the 29th Regiment of Foot, along with 50 more Hessian artillerymen to help man the guns. All in total, the crew of this vessel was about 300 men in all. Though, that was going to be way too much for this vessel. It was just not big enough to house 300 men. Now, the gun crews were a mix of British and Hessian soldiers, except for the 12-pounders in the bow and the stern, which were manned completely by Germans. The artillery officer in charge, was Captain Gorig Pausch, and he was an artillery officer that arrived with the second convoy of Hessians. He actually comments in his journal about working with the English gunners. "This afternoon, 5 o'clock, I practiced with the English cannoneers firing with English cannon, in the English fashion, and though it went very well, I do, however, wish I had my own cannon." Now, the crowded conditions aboard the Thunderer made it very difficult for men to get comfortable. It rained the first night they were on board, and so that made things even more uncomfortable. The men would take shifts manning the guns. It almost had a 24-hour guard. So Pausch put his men on the watch for the night, and the Thunderer was planned to take off in the morning and head to Isle Anou. Of course, we talked about how unruly this ship was to try and sail. It was so bad that the commander of the vessel basically just gave up. He used a way to move the Thunderer down there that's known as kedging. And what this basically means is that the ship would have to be pulled downriver by the anchor. What they would kind of do is use the, I guess the easiest way to explain it is that they use the current to pull the vessel, but they would lower the anchor so that they could control the vessel more. So they would let the anchor out, it would be moved into a position, and then they would pull up the anchor, it would move a little bit more, and then they would drop the, you know, it was just a way to control it. It's a, you have to kind of like see it in action, understand it. Everything I see from visual aids and from anything that anyone's written about it, it's a very complicated thing. You need tugboats and everything. So that's what they basically have to do to move the ship around. They have to pull it around by the anchor. So for me, the Thunderer was a complete waste of time and a complete waste of manpower, because they could have built four smaller vessels that could have done the same thing instead of trying to move this hunking floating battery around, because that's basically what it is at this point. It's just a floating battery. So we are finally into October, and by October 5th, the entire British fleet was anchored off Isle Anu. The plan was to move 7 miles south, and on October 7th, they would meet up with the British forces under Simon Fraser. The meeting point was Rivière La Colée, if I'm pronouncing that right. My French is pretty bad at this point. Well, on October 7th, the fleet was still waiting for the Inflexible to arrive. While Fraser and his land forces had arrived, they were still waiting for probably one of the most impressive ships that was going to be on the water. Fraser, not wanting to wait around, continued his men to head south to Point au Fer. The planned outline of the battle for the British ships was they were going to have the three small gunboats lead the way. They were kind of like the skirmishers' scout ships. They would be followed by the larger ships of the line. So we're talking the schooners, the Inflexible, the Royal Convert. So they're going to be behind them. Behind the ships of the line would be 20 or so more gunboats, small attack vessels that mounted a 12 or 24-pound cannon in the bow. They had about 7 artillerymen and 11 sailors to man these small boats. The gunboats were placed under the command of whoever the artillery officer was. So the ship wasn't actually commanded by a sailor, it was commanded by an artillery officer. Behind the gunboats was the rest of the army in the bateau. Now, the soldiers themselves were drilling constantly on the oars, and they were becoming quite good at maneuvering all around. But when it came to a fight, it would be dangerous for them if any American vessels got through. The big ships that the Americans were sporting would just slaughter the bateau. They had real no defenses. So the commanders decided that in the event of an open fight on the water, the bateau would make for the shore and wait out the outcome. And in all this time, we are still waiting for the Inflexible. But why is the Inflexible such an important thing? Well, she launches on September 29th, but she had displaced so much water that the crew had to take her time getting the ship downriver. She carried 18 12-pounders. The guns themselves weighed over 27 tons. They actually, because the water was, it had a shallow draft, or, well, the Inflexible had a deeper draft than some of the more shallow drafted boats, and though the river there was deep, the Inflexible displaced so much water, and now you're going to add 27 tons of bronze and carriage, that it would have run aground in a matter of moments. It would have just actually just displaced more water and then ended up resting on the riverbed. So what they actually have to do is take all the guns off, put them on boats, and row them downriver. So this took a lot of time. And finally, on October 10th, the Inflexible would join the fleet. So what was the deal with this ship? You know, the Inflexible was a real undertaking to build in the first place. You know, moving the schooners was simple work compared to this. We talked about the schooners. They had to take off the rigging. Sometimes they took down the masts. They took all the extra pieces of unessential equipment off, cannons, some of the deck coverings. And what they did was they pulled away some of the lower boards along the keel, and basically they ran wooden rods through there, large wooden rods that a large group of men, because it wasn't done by just a few, probably 100 or so men, would lift the ship itself, you know, and move it down river until they got it to St. John, where they could then reattach everything and then drop it in the water. The Inflexible was a completely different beast. I mean, we're talking a ship that is three-mast, square-masted, had an elevated quarterdeck. This was a full-size hull. This was a standard-size ship of the line. So the ship has to be completely dismantled. Nothing more than the keel could be moved down to St. John. So then they would have to reattach all the boards and everything when they got there. And so when it does get to St. John on September 5th, everything is laid out, and the shipwrights get to work on it. It would take 28 days for them to get this ship ready to sail. The question that historians will ask, though, was it worth the trouble? It took a lot of manpower to get this ship ready to sail. What if Carleton had put his men to work on other ships? If he does that, does he buy himself some time and be able to move downriver before Arnold had some of his rogue galleys available to him? Could they move against Fort Ticonderoga before the end of the campaign season? Do we have a battle in 1776? These are all questions that historians have asked over time. But it's not going to be so much Carleton's wasted time as Benedict Arnold's sterling effort. So in the second week of October 1776, the British will take off in search of the only military force between them and Fort Ticonderoga. And that's where we're going to leave it off this week. I know we left a lot of questions, but I kind of wanted to just present the British side of things. This episode was short. It's sweet. It gave us, got us to the point. I wanted to present the British side of things because next week we're going to be full on into the Battle of Valcour Island, and we're from there. We are not stopping until the end. No breaks, no nothing. We're going to go. I'm going to do the entire battle in one episode, and it's going to be quite an episode. Because for those that don't know about the Battle of Valcour Island, it is probably one of the most interesting and underappreciated naval battles of the entire American Revolution. It is quite a feat to see what Benedict Arnold was able to do and see what the British had done in their timetables and the raw energy and devotion that the Americans had to defending the lake as best as they could. So with that epic promo, I'm going to leave off this week. Remember, if you guys download the podcast from iTunes, please go into iTunes, leave me a 5-star rating, possibly a review. Those are always helpful, but a 5-star rating is the most important. This way it gets the podcast out there for more people. It'll be higher up on the suggestion list. So if someone's looking around for a podcast that has to do with history, if I have enough 5-star ratings, this will be something that they'll suggest to people. Hey, if you like history, check this guy's podcast out. As always, the Facebook is there if you have questions. I also like getting the likes on Facebook, so you know, keep those going as well. I appreciate all the listeners. And just remember, no matter what you do, keep that powder dry. Have a good week, everyone.